Sergeant Detritus's approach to these matters was almost instinctively correct. He had the palace staff lined up in front of him and was shouting at them at the top of his voice. "Look at old Detritus," Vimes thought as he went down the stairs. "Just your basic thick troll a few years ago. Now a valuable member of the watch, provided you get him to repeat his orders back to you to make sure he understands you. His armor gleams even brighter than Carrot's because he doesn't get bored with polishing. And he's mastered policing as it is practiced by the majority of forces in the universe, which is basically screaming angrily at people until they give in. The only reason that he's not a one-troll reign of terror is the ease with which his thought process can be derailed by anyone who tries something fiendishly cunning, like an outright denial. I know you all done it," he was shouting. "If the person what done it does not own up, der whole staff, and I means this, der whole staff will be locked up in der tanty, and also we throws der key away." He pointed a finger at a stout scullery maid. "It was you what done it. Own up." "No." Detritus paused. "Then, where were you last night? Own up." "In bed, of course." "Aha! Dat a likely story. Own up. Dat where you always is at night?" "Of course." "Aha! Own up. You got witnesses?" "Sauce." "Ah. So you got no witnesses. You done it, then. Own up." "No." "Oh. All right. Thank you, Sergeant. That will be all for now," said Vimes, patting him on the shoulder. "All the staff here?" He glared at the lineup. "Well, are you all here?" There was a certain amount of reluctant shuffling among the ranks. And then someone cautiously put up a hand. "Mildred Easy hasn't been seen since yesterday," said its owner. "She's the upstairs maid. A boy came with a message. She had to go off to see her family." Vimes felt the faintest of prickles at the back of his neck. "Anyone know why?" he said. "Dunno, sir. She left all her stuff." "All right, Sergeant. Before you go off shift, get someone to find her. Then go and get some sleep. The rest of you, go and get on with whatever it is you do. Mr. Drumknot? The patrician's personal clerk, who'd been watching Detritus's technique with a horrified expression, looked up. "Yes, Commander? What's this book? Is it his lordship's diary?" Drumknot took the book. "It looks like it, certainly. Have you been able to crack the code?" "I didn't know it was in code, Commander." "What? You never looked at it?" "Why should I, sir? It's not mine." "You do know his last secretary tried to kill him?" "Yes, sir. I ought to say, sir, that I have already been exhaustively interrogated by your men." Drumknot opened the book and raised his eyebrows. "What did they say?" said Vimes. Drumknot looked up thoughtfully. "Let me see now. It was you what done it. Own up. Everybody's seen you. We got lots of people say you done it. You done it all right, didn't you? Own up." "That was, I think, the general approach. And then, like the scullery maid just now, I said it wasn't me, and that seemed to puzzle the officer concerned." Drumknot delicately licked his finger and turned a page. Vimes stared at him. The sound of saws was brisk on the morning air. Captain Carrot knocked against the timber yard door, which was eventually opened. "Good morning, sir," he said. "I understand you have a golem here." "Had," said the timber merchant. "Oh dear, another one," said Angua. "That made four so far." The one in the foundry had knelt under a hammer. The one in the stonemason's yard was now 10 clay toes sticking out from under a 2-ton block of limestone. One working in the docks had been seen in the river, striding towards the sea, and now this one. "It was weird," said the merchant, thumping the golem's chest. "Sydney said it went on sawing all the way up to the moment it sawed its head right off." I've got a load of ash planking got to go out this afternoon. Who's going to saw it up, may I ask? Angua picked up the golem's head. Insofar as it had any expression at all, it was one of intense concentration. Here, said the merchant. Alf told me he heard in the drum last night the golems have been murdering people. Inquiries are continuing, said Carrot. Now then, mister, it's Preble Skink, isn't it? Your brother runs the lamp oil shop in at Cable Street. And your daughter is a maid at the university? The man looked astonished, but Carrot knew everyone. Yeah. Did your golem leave the yard yesterday evening? Well, yeah, early on. Something about a holy day. He looked nervously from one to the other. You got to let them go. Otherwise, the words in their heads. And then it came back and worked all night? Yeah, what else would it do? And then Alf came in on early turn, and he said it came up out of the saw pit, stood there for a moment, and then, was it sawing pine logs yesterday, said Angua? That's right. Where am I going to get another golem at short notice, may I ask? What's this, said Angua. She picked up a wood-framed square from a heap of sawdust. This was its slate, was it? She handed it to Carrot. Thou shalt not kill, Carrot read slowly. Clay of my clay. Ashamed. Do you have any idea why I did write this? That? Search me, said Skink. They're always doing dumb things. He brightened up a bit. Hey, perhaps it went potty. Get it? Clay. Pot. Potty. Extremely funny, said Carrot gravely. I will take this as evidence. Good morning. Why did you ask about pine logs, he said to Angua as they stepped outside. I smelled the same pine resin in the cellar. Pine resin's just pine resin, isn't it? No, not to me. That golem was in there. They all were, sighed Carrot, and now they're committing suicide. You can't take life you haven't got, said Angua. What shall we call it, then? Destruction of property, said Carrot. Anyway, we can't ask them now, he tapped the slate. They've given us the answers, he said. Perhaps we can find out what the question should have been. What do you mean, nothing? Said Vimes. It's got to be the book. He licks his fingers to turn a page, and every day he gets a little dose of arsenic. Fiendishly clever. Sorry, sir, said Cheery, backing away. I can't find a trace. I've used all the tests I know. You're sure? I could send it up to the Unseen University. They've built a new morphic resonator in the high-energy magic building, which magic would easily... Don't do that, said Vimes. We'll keep the wizards out of this. Damn, for half an hour there, I really thought I'd got it. He sat down at his desk. Something new was odd about the dwarf, but he couldn't quite work out what it was. We're missing something here, Little Bottom, he said. Yes, sir. Let's look at the facts. If you want to poison someone slowly, you've either got to give them small doses at the time, or at least every day. We've covered everything the patrician does. It can't be the air in the room. You and I have been in there every day. It's not the food. We're pretty sure of that. Is something stinging him? Can you poison a wasp? What we need... Excuse me, sir. Vimes turned. Detritus, I thought you were off duty. I got them to give to me their address of that maid called Easy, like you said, said Detritus, stoically. I went up there, and there was people all looking in. What do you mean? Neighbors and that. Crying women all around. Der door. And I remember that what you said about that diplo word. Diplomacy, said Vimes. Yeah. Not shouting at people and that. I thought this looked a delicate situation. Also, Day was throwing stuff at me. So I came back here. I writ down der address. And now I'm going home. He saluted, rocked slightly from the force of the blow to the side of his head, and departed. Thanks, Detritus, said Vimes. He looked at the paper written in the troll's big round hand. First floor back. 27 Cockbull Street, he said. Good grief. You know it, sir? Should. I was born in that street, said Vimes. It's down below the shades. Easy. Easy. Yes. Now I remember. There was a Mrs. Easy down the road. Skinny woman. Did a lot of sewing. Big family. Well, we were all big families. It was the only way to keep warm. He found out the paper. It wasn't as if it were any particular lead. Maidservants were always going off to see their mothers. Every time there was the least little family upset. What was it his granny used to say? Your son's your son till he takes a wife. But your daughter's your daughter all your life. Sending a watchman around would almost certainly be a waste of everyone's time. Well, Cockbill Street, he said. He stared at the paper again. You might as well rename the place Memory Lane. No, you couldn't waste to watch resources on a wild goose chase like that. But he might look in, on his way past, sometime today. Little Bottom? Sir? On your lips, red, on your lips. Lipstick, sir. Lipstick? Fine. Lipstick. Constable Angua gave it to me, sir. That was kind of her, said Vimes. I expect. It was called the Rat's Chamber. In theory, this was because of the decoration. Some former resident of the palace had thought that a fresco of dancing rats would be a real decorative coup. There was a pattern of rats woven in the carpet. At the ceiling, rats danced in a circle, their tails intertwining at the center. After half an hour in that room, most people wanted a wash. Soon, then, there would be a big rush on the hot water. The room was filling up fast. By common consent, the chair was taken and amply filled by Mrs. Rosemary Palm, head of the Guild of Seamstresses, as one of the most senior guild leaders. Quiet, please, gentlemen. The noise level subsided a little. Dr. Downey, she said. The head of the Assassin's Guild nodded. My friends, I think we are all aware of the situation, he began. Yeah, so's your accountant, said a voice in the crowd. There was a ripple of nervous laughter. But it didn't last long, because you don't laugh too loud at someone who knows exactly how much you're worth dead. Dr. Downey smiled. I can assure you once again, gentlemen and ladies, that I am aware of no engagement regarding Lord Veterinary. In any case, I cannot imagine that an assassin would use poison in this case. His lordship spent some time in the assassin's school. He knows the uses of caution. No doubt he will recover. And if he doesn't, said Mrs. Palm. No one lives forever, said Dr. Downey, in the calm voice of a man who personally knew this to be true. Then, no doubt, we'll get a new ruler. The room went very silent. The word who hovered silently above every head. The thing is, said Gerhard Sock, head of the Butcher's Guild, you've got to admit it, it's been, well, think about some of the others. The word Lord Snapcase, now, at least this one isn't actually insane, flickered in the group's consciousness. I have to admit, said Mrs. Palm, that under Veterinary, it has certainly been safer to walk the streets. You should know, madame, said Mr. Sock. Mrs. Palm gave him an icy look. There were a few sniggers. I meant that a modest payment to the Thieves' Guild is all that is required for perfect safety, she finished. And indeed, a man may visit a house of ill-negotiable hospitality, said Mrs. Palm quickly. Aye, indeed, and be quite confident of not waking up stripped stark naked and beaten black and blue, said Sick. Unless his tastes run that way, said Mrs. Palm, we aim to give satisfaction, very accurately, if required. Life has certainly been more reliable under Fetnary, said Mr. Potts of the Baker's Guild. He does have a street theater play, have all street theater players and mime artists thrown into the scorpion pit, said Mr. Bogus of the Thieves Guild. True, but let's not forget that he has his bad points, too. The man is capricious. You think so? Compared to the ones we had before, he's as reliable as a rock. Snapcase was reliable, said Mr. Sox gloomily. Remember when he made his horse a city councillor? You've got to admit it wasn't a bad councillor compared to some of the others. As I recall, the others at that time were a vase of flowers, a heap of sand, and three people who had been beheaded. Remember all those fights? All the little gangs of thieves fighting all the time? It got so that there was hardly any energy left to actually steal things, said Mr. Bogus. Things are indeed more reliable now. Silence descended again. That was it, wasn't it? Things were reliable now. Whatever else you said about old Veterinary, he made sure today was always followed by tomorrow. If you were murdered in your bed, at least it would be by arrangement. Things were more exciting under Lord Snapcase, someone ventured. Yes, right up to the point when your head fell off. The trouble is, said Mr. Bogus, the job makes people mad. You take some chap who's no worse than any of us, and after a few months, he's talking to Moss and having people flayed alive. Veterinary isn't mad. Depends how you look at it. No one can be as sane as he is without being mad. I am only a weak woman, said Mrs. Palm, to the personal disbelief of several present. But it does seem to me that there's an opportunity here. Either there's a long struggle to sort out a successor, or we sort it out now. Yes? The guild leaders tried to look at one another, while simultaneously avoiding everyone else's glances. Who'd be Patricia now? Once there'd have been a huge multi-sided struggle, but now you got the power, but you got the problems too. Things had changed. These days, you had to negotiate and juggle with all the conflicting interests. No one sane had tried to kill Veterinary for years, because the world with him in it was just preferable to one without him. Besides, Veterinary had tamed Ankh Morpork. He tamed it like a dog. He'd taken a minor scavenger among scavengers and lengthened its teeth and strengthened its jaws and built up its muscles and studded its collar and fed it lean steak, and then he'd aimed it at the throat of the world. He'd taken all the gangs and squabbling groups and made them see that a small slice of the cake on a regular basis was better by far than a bigger slice with a dagger in it. He made them see that it was better to take a small slice but enlarge the cake. Ankh Morpork, alone of all the cities of the plains, had opened its gates to dwarfs and trolls. Alloys are stronger, as Veterinary had said. It had worked. They made things. Often they made trouble, but mostly they made wealth. As a result, although Ankh Morpork still had many enemies, those enemies had to finance their armies with borrowed money. Most of it was borrowed from Ankh Morpork at punitive interest. There hasn't been any really big wars for years. Ankh Morpork had made them unprofitable. Thousands of years ago, the old empire had enforced the Pax Morporcia, which had said to the world, "Do not fight, or we will kill you." The Pax had arisen again, but this time it said, "If you fight, we'll call in your mortgages. And incidentally, that's my pike you're pointing at me. I paid for that shield you're holding, and take my helmet off when you speak to me, you horrible little debtor." And now the whole machine, which whirred away so quietly that people had forgotten it was a machine at all, and thought that it was just the way the world worked, had given a lurch. The guild leaders examined their thoughts and decided what they did not want was power. What they wanted was that tomorrow should be pretty much like today. There's the dwarf, said Mr. Bogus. Even if one of us, not that I'm saying it would be one of us, of course, even if someone took over, what about the dwarfs? We got someone like Snapcase again. There's going to be chopped kneecaps in the streets. You're not suggesting we have some sort of vote, are you? Some kind of popularity contest? Oh, no. It's all more complicated. All more complicated now. And power goes to people's heads. And then other people's heads fall off. I wish you wouldn't keep on saying that, whoever you are, said Mrs. Palm. Anyone would think you'd had your head cut off. Oh, it's you, Mr. Slant. I do apologize. Speaking as the president of the Guild of Lawyers, said Mr. Slant, and the most respected zombie in Ankh-Morpork, I must recommend stability in this matter. I wonder if I may offer some advice. How much will it cost us, said Mr. Sock. Stability, said Mr. Slant, equals monarchy. Oh, now don't tell us. Look at Clatch, and said Mr. Slant doggedly. Generations of serfs, result political stability. Take Pseudopolis, or Stolot, or even the Agatian Empire. Come on, said Dr. Downey. Everyone knows that kings, monarchs come and go. They depose one another, and so on and so forth, said Mr. Slant. But the institution goes on. Besides, I think you'll find that it is possible to work out an accommodation. He realized that he had the floor. His fingers absent-mindedly touched the seam where his head had been sewn back on. All those years ago, Mr. Slant had refused to die until he had been paid for the disbursements in the matter of conducting his own defense. How do you mean? Said Mr. Potts. I accept that the question of resurrecting the Ankh-Morpork succession had been raised several times recently, said Mr. Slant. Yes, by madmen, said Mr. Bogus. It's part of the symptoms. But put underpants on head, talk to trees, drool, decide that Ankh-Morpork needs a king. Exactly. Supposing sane men were to give it consideration. Go on, said Dr. Downey. There have been precedents, said Mr. Slamp. Monarchies who have found themselves bereft of a convenient monarch have obtained one. Some suitably born member of some other royal line. After all, what is required is someone who knows the ropes, as I believe the saying goes. Sorry, are you saying we send out for a king? Said Mr. Bogus. We put up some kind of advertisement. Throne vacant. Applicant must supply own crown. In fact, said Mr. Slant, ignoring this, I recall that, during the First Empire, Gimwan wrote to Ankh-Morpork and asked to be sent one of our generals as to be their king. Their own royal lines having died out through interbreeding so intensively that the last king kept trying to breed with himself. The history books say that we sent our loyal General Tacticus, whose first act after obtaining the crown was to declare war on Ankh-Morpork. Kings are interchangeable. You mentioned something about reaching an accommodation, said Mr. Bogus. You mean we tell a king what to do? I like the sound of that, said Mrs. Palm. I like the echoes, said Dr. Downey. Not tell, said Mr. Slant. We agree. Obviously, as king, he would concentrate on those things traditionally associated with kingship. Waving, said Mr. Sock. Being gracious, said Mrs. Palm. Welcoming ambassadors from foreign countries, said Mr. Potts. Shaking hands. Cutting off heads. No, no. No, that will not be part of his duties. Minor affairs of state will be carried out by his advisors, said Dr. Downey. He leaned back. I'm sure I can see where this is going, Mr. Slant, he said. But kings are acquired. Once acquired, are so damn hard to get rid of. Acceptably. There have been precedents for that, too, said Mr. Slant. The assassin's eyes narrowed. I'm intrigued, Mr. Slant, that as soon as the Lord Veterinary appears to be seriously ill, you pop up with suggestions like this. Sounds like A remarkable coincidence. There is no mystery, I assure you. Destiny works its course. Surely many of you have heard the rumors that there is, in this city, someone with a bloodline traceable all the way back to the last royal family. Someone working in this very city in a comparatively humble position. A lowly watchman, in fact. There were some nods, but not very definite ones. They were to nods what a grunt is to yes. The guilds all picked up information. No one wanted to reveal how much or how little. They personally knew, just in case they knew too little or, too, even worse, turned out to know too much. However, Doc Pseudopoulos of the Guild of Gamblers put on a careful poker face and said, yes, but the tricentennial is coming up, and in a few years it'll be the century of the rat. There's something about centuries that gives people a kind of fever. Nevertheless, the person exists, said Mr. Slant. The evidence stares one in the face if one looks in the right places. Very well, said Mr. Bogus. Tell us the name of this captain. He often lost large sums at poker. Captain, said Mr. Slant, I'm sorry to say his natural talents have thus far not commended him to that extent. He is a corporal. Corporal C.W. St. J. Nobbs. There was silence. And then there was a strange putting sound, like water negotiating its way through a partially blocked pipe. Queen Molly of the Beggar's Guild had so far been silent, apart from occasional damp sucking noises as she tried to dislodge a particle of her lunch from the things which, because they were still in her mouth and apparently attached, were technically her teeth. Now she was laughing. The hairs wobbled on every wart. Nobby Nobbs, she said. You're talking about Nobby Nobbs. He is the last known descendant of the Earl of Ankh. Who could trace his descent all the way to a distant cousin of the last king, said Mr. Slant. It's the talk of the city. A picture forms in my mind, said Dr. Downey. Small, monkey-like chap, always smoking very short cigarettes, spotty. He squeezes them in public. That's Nobby, Queen Molly chuckled. Face like a blind carpenter's thumb. Him? But the man's a tit. And dim as a penny candle, said Mr. Bogus. I don't see... Suddenly he stopped, and then contracted the contemplated silence that was gradually affecting everyone else around the table. Don't see why we shouldn't give this due consideration, he said after a while. The assembled leaders looked at the table. Then they looked at the ceiling. Then they studiously avoided one another's gaze. Blood will out, said Mr. Carey. When I've watched him go down the street, I've always thought, there's a man who walks in greatness, said Mrs. Palm. He squeezes them in a very regal way, mind you, very graciously. The silence rolled over the assembly again, but it was busy, in the same way that the silence of an anthill is busy. I must remind you, ladies and gentlemen, though poor Lord Ventnor is still alive, said Mrs. Palm. Indeed, indeed, said Mr. Slant, and long may he remain so. I've merely set out for you one option against this day. That day, may it be a long time coming, when we should consider a successor. In any case, said Dr. Downey, there is no doubt that the veterinary had been overdoing it. If he survives, which is greatly to be hoped, of course, I feel we should require him to step down for the sake of his health. Well done, thou good and faithful servant, and so on. Buy him a nice house in the country somewhere. Give him a pension. Make sure there's a seat for him at official dinners. Obviously, if he can be so easily poisoned now, he should welcome the release from the chains of office. What about the wizard? Said Mr. Bogus.
They've never got involved in civic concerns, said Dr. Downey. Give them 4 meat meals a day and tip your hat to them and they're happy. They know nothing about politics. The silence that followed was broken by the voice of Queen Molly of the Beggars. What about Vimes? Dr. Downey shrugged. He is a servant of the city.
That's what I mean. Surely we represent the city.
Ha, he won't see it that way. And you know what Vimes thinks about kings. It was a Vimes who chopped the head off the last one. There's a bloodline that thinks a swing of an axe can solve anything. Now, Molly, you know Vimes would probably take an axe to veterinary if he thought he could get away with it. No love lost there, I fancy. He won't like it. That's all I tell you. That's all I tell you. Veterinary keeps Vimes wound up. No knowing what happens if he unwinds all at once. He's a public servant, snapped Dr. Downey. Queen Molly made a face, which was not difficult and one so naturally well endowed, and sat back. So this is the new way of things, is it? She muttered. Lots of ordinary men sit around a table and talk, and suddenly the world's a different place. The sheep turned round and charged the shepherd. There's a soiree at Lady Solace's house that evening. This evening, said Dr. Downey, ignoring her. I believe Nobbs has been being invited. Perhaps we can meet him.
Vimes told himself he was really going to inspect the progress of the new watch house in Chitling Street. Cockbill Street was just round the corner, and then he'd call in, informally. No sense in sparing a man when they were pushed anyway. That, what with these murders and veterinary and detritus's anti-slab crusade. He turned the corner and stopped. Much had changed. That was the shocking thing. After, too many years, things had no right not to have changed. But washing lines still crisscrossed the street between the gray ancient buildings. Antique paint still peeled in the way cheap paint peeled when it had been painted on wood too old and rotten to take paint. Cockbill Street people were usually too penniless to afford decent paint, but always far too proud to use whitewash. And the place was slightly smaller than he remembered. That was all. When had he last come down here? He couldn't remember. It was beyond the shades, and up until quite recently, the watch had tended to leave that area to its own unspeakable devices. Unlike the shades, though, Cockbill Street was clean, with the haunting empty cleanliness you get when people can't afford to waste dirt. For Cockbill Street was where people lived who were worse than poor, because they didn't know how poor they were. If you asked them, they would probably say something like, "Mustn't grumble," or "There's far worse than off than us," or "We've always kept us heads above water, and we don't owe nobody nout." He could hear his granny speaking, "No one's too poor to buy soap." Of course, many people were. But in Cockbill Street, they bought soap just the same. The table might not have any food on it, but by God, it was well scrubbed. That was Cockbill Street, where what you mainly ate was your pride. What a mess the world was in, Vimes reflected. Constable Visit had told him the meek would inherit the earth, inherit it. And what had the poor devils done to deserve that? Cockbill Street people would stand aside to let the meek through. For what kept them in Cockbill Street, mentally and physically, was their vague comprehension that there were rules, and they went through life filled with a quiet, distracted dread that they weren't quite obeying them. People said that there was one law for the rich and one law for the poor, but it wasn't true. There was no law for those who made the law, and no law for the incorrigibly lawless. All the laws and rules were for those people stupid enough to think like Cockbill Street people. It was oddly quiet. Normally, there'd be swarms of kids and carts headed down towards the docks, but today the place had a shut-in look. In the middle of the road was a chalked hopscotch path. Vimes felt his knees go weak. It was still here. When had he last seen it? 35 years ago? 40? So it must have been drawn and redrawn thousands of times. He'd been pretty good at it, of course. They'd played it by Ankh Morpork rules. Instead of kicking a stone, they'd kicked William Scuggins. It had been just one of the many inventive games they'd played, which had involved kicking, chasing, or jumping on William Scuggins until he threw one of his famous wobblers and started frothing and violently attacking himself. Vimes had been able to drop William in the square of his choice 9 times out of 10. The 10th time, William bit his leg. In those days, tormenting William and finding enough to eat had made for a simple, straightforward life. There weren't so many questions you didn't know the answers to, except maybe how to stop your leg festering. Sir Samuel looked around, saw the silent street, and flicked a stone out of the gutter with his foot. Then he booted it surreptitiously along the squares, adjusted his cloak, and hopped and jumped his way up, turned, hopped. What was it you shouted as you hopped? Salt, mustard, vinegar, pepper? No? Or was it the one that went, William Scuggins is a bastard? Now he'd wonder about that all day. A door opened across the street. Vimes froze, one leg in midair, as two black-clothed figures came out slowly and awkwardly. This was because they were carrying a coffin. The natural solemnity of the occasion was diminished by their having to squeeze around it and out into the street, pulling the casket after them and allowing two other pairs of bearers to edge their way into the daylight. Vimes remembered himself in time to lower his other foot, and then remembered even more of himself and snatched his helmet off in respect. Another coffin emerged. It was a lot smaller. It needed only two people to carry it, and that was really one too many. As mourners trooped out behind them, Vimes fumbled in a pocket for the scrap of paper to try to say given him. The scene was, in its way, funny. Like the bit in a circus where the coach stops and a dozen clowns get out of it. Apartment houses round here made up for their limited number of rooms by having a large number of people occupy them. He found the paper and unfolded it. First floor back, 27 Cockbill Street. And this was it. He'd arrived in time for a funeral. Two funerals. Looks like it's really a bad day to be a golem, said Angua. There was a pottery hand lying in the gutter. That's the third one we've seen smashed in the street. There was a crash up ahead, and a dwarf came through a window, more or less horizontally. His iron helmet stuck sparks as he hit the street. But the dwarf was soon up again and plunging back through the adjacent doorway. He emerged via the window again a moment later, but was fielded by Carrot, who set him on his feet. "Hello, Mr. Orsmiter. Are you keeping well? And what is happening here?" "It's that devil Gimlet, Captain Carrot. You should be arresting him." "Why, what's he done?" "He's been poisoning people, that's what." Carrot glanced at Angua, then back at Orsmiter. "Poison," he said. "That's a very serious allegation. You're telling me. I was up all night with Mrs. Orsmiter. I didn't think much about it until I came in here this morning, and there were other people complaining." He tried to struggle out of Carrot's grip. "You know what?" he said. "You know what? We looked in his cold room, and you know what? You know what he's been selling as meat?" "Tell me," said Carrot. "Pork and beef." "Oh, dear. And lamb." "Ch-ch." "Hardly any rat at all." Carrot shook his head at the duplicity of traders. "And Snorri Gladson Unkelson said he had rat surprise last night, and he'll swear there were chicken bones in it." Carrot let go of the dwarf. "You stay here," he said to Angua, and head bowed, stepped inside Gimlet's whole food delicatessen. An axe spun toward him. He caught it almost absent-mindedly and tossed it casually aside. Ow! There was a melee of dwarfs around the counter. The row had already grown well past the stage when it had anything much to do with the subject in hand, and these being dwarfs, took in other matters of vital importance, such as whose grandfather had stolen whose grandfather's mining claim 300 years ago, and whose axe was at whose throat right now. But there was something about Carrot's presence. The fighting gradually stopped. The fighters tried to look as if they'd just happened to be standing there. There was a sudden and general axe. What axe? Oh, this axe? I was just showing it to my friend Bjorn here. Good old Bjorn, feel to the atmosphere. All right, said Carrot. What's all this about, poison? Mr. Gimlet first. It's a diabolical lie, shouted Gimlet from somewhere under the heap. I run a wholesome restaurant. My tables are so clean, you could eat your dinner off them. Carrot raised his hands to stop the outburst this caused. Someone said something about rats, he said. I told them I use only the very best rats, shouted Gimlet. Good plump rats from the best locations. None of your latrine rubbish. And they're hard to come by, let me tell you. And when you can't get them, Mr. Gimlet, said Carrot. Gimlet paused. Carrot was hard to lie to. All right, he mumbled. Maybe when there's not enough, I might sort of plump out the stock with some chicken. Maybe just a bit of beef. Ha, a bit? That's right. You should see his cold room, Mr. Carrot. Yeah, he uses steak and cuts the little legs in it and covers it with rat sauce. I don't know. You try to do your best at very reasonable prices. And this is the thanks you get, said Gimlet hotly. It's hard enough to make ends meet as it is. You don't even make them of the right meat. Carrot sighed. There was no public health laws in Ankh-Morpork. It would be like installing smoke detectors in hell. All right, he said. But you can't get poisoned by steak. No, honestly. No, shut up. All of you. No, I don't care what your mother's told you. Now, I want to know about this poisoning, Gimlet. Gimlet struggled to his feet. We did rat surprise last night for the sons of Bloodaxe's annual dinner, he said. There was a general groan, and it was rat. He raised his voice against the complaining. You can't use anything else. Listen, you've got to have the noses poking through the pastry, all right? Some of the best rat we've had in for a long time, let me tell you. And you were all ill afterwards, said Carrot, taking out his notebook. Sweating all night. Couldn't see straight. I reckon I know every knothole on the back of the privy door. I'll write that down as a definitely, said Carrot. Was there anything else on the dinner menu? Vol-au-vent and cream of rat, said Gimlet. All hygienically prepared. How do you mean hygienically prepared? Said Carrot. The chef is under strict orders to wash his hands afterwards. The assembled dwarfs nodded. This was certainly pretty hygienic. You didn't want people going around with ratty hands. Anyway, you've all been eating here for years, said Gimlet, sensing the slight veer in his direction. This is the first time there's been any trouble, isn't it? My rats are famous. Your chicken's going to be pretty famous, too, said Carrot. There was laughter this time. Even Gimlet joined in. All right, I'm sorry about the chicken, but it was that or very poor rats. And you know I only buy from Wee Mat Arthur. He's trustworthy, whatever else you might say about him. You just can't get better rats. Everyone knows that. That'll be Wee Mat Arthur in Gleam Street, said Carrot. Yes, not a mark on him most of the time. Have you got any left? One or two, Gimlet's expression changed. Here, you don't think he poisoned them, do you? I never did trust that little bugger. Inquiries are continuing, said Carrot. He tucked his notebook away. "I'd like some rats, please. Those rats. To go." He glanced at the menu, patted his pocket, and looked questioningly out through the door at Angua. "You don't have to buy them," she said wearily. "They're evidence. We can't defraud an innocent tradesman who may be the victim of circumstances," said Carrot. "You want ketchup?" said Gimlet. "Only they're extra with ketchup." The funeral carriage went slowly through the streets. It looked quite expensive, but that was Cockbill Street for you. People put money by. Vimes remembered that. You always put money by in Cockbill Street. You saved up for a rainy day even if it was pouring already. And you'd die of shame if people thought you could afford only a cheap funeral. Half a dozen black-clad mourners came along behind. Although altogether with perhaps a score of people who had tried at least to look respectable. Vimes followed the procession at a distance all the way to the cemetery behind the Temple of Small Gods, where he lurked awkwardly among the gravestones and somber graveyard trees while the priest mumbled on. The gods have made the people of Cockbill Street poor, honest, improvident. Vimes reflected they might as well have hung signs saying "kick me" on their backs and had done with it. But Cockbill Street people tended towards religion, at least of the less demonstrative kind. They always put a little left life by for a rainy eternity. Eventually, the crowd around the graves broke up and drifted away with the aimless look of people whose immediate future contains hammerels. Vimes spotted a tearful young woman in the main group and advanced carefully. Are you Mildred Easy?" he said. She nodded. "Who are you?" She took in the cut of his coat and added, "Sir?" "Was that old Mrs. Easy who used to do dressmaking?" said Vimes, taking her gently aside. "That's right. And the smaller coffin? That was our William." The girl looked as if she were about to cry again. "Can we have a talk?" said Vimes. "There are some things I hope you can tell me." He hated the way his mind worked. A proper human being would have shown respect and quietly walked away. But as he'd stood among the chilly stones, a horrible apprehension had stolen over him that almost all the answers were in place now. If only he could work out the questions. She looked around at the other mourners. They had reached the gates and were staring back curiously at the two of them. "I know this isn't the right time," said Vimes, "but when the kids play hopscotch, is this in the street? What's the rhyme they sing? Salt, mustard, vinegar, pepper, isn't it?" She stared at his worried grin. "That's a skipping rhyme," she said coldly. "When they play hopscotch, they sing Billy Skunkins is a brass stud. Who are you?" "I'm Commander Vimes of the Watch," said Vimes. "So Willie Skunkins would live on in the street in disguise and in a fashion. An old stone face was just some guy on a bonfire." Then her tears came. It's all right, said Vimes, as soothingly as he could. "I was brought up in Cockbill Street. That's why I'm not out to look. I know you took food home from the place. That's all right, Bimi. I'm not here to..." "Oh, damn. Would you like my handkerchief? I think your one's full. Everyone does it." "Yes, I know. Anyway, cook never says nothing." She began to sob. "Yes, yes. Everyone takes a few things," said Mildred Easy. "It's not like stealing." "It is," thought Vimes treacherously, "but I don't give a damn." And now, he'd got a grip on the long copper rod and was climbing into a high place while the thunder buttered around him. The last food you saw... "were given," she said. He said, "What was it?" "Just some blancmange and some, you know, that sort of jam made out of meat. Pâté?" "Yes, I thought it would be a little treat." Vimes nodded. "Rich, mushy food. the sort you'd give to a baby who was peaky and to a granny who hadn't got any teeth. Well, he was on the roof now. The clouds were black and threatening, and he might as well wave the lightning rod. Time to ask the wrong question, as it proved. Tell me, he said, what did Mrs. Easy die of?